this is maybe the scariest part to me, eventually everyone I've ever seen who's been in high conflict ends up mimicking the behavior of their adversary.
The Center for Understanding and Conflict welcomes you to The Other Chair, a show that explores the dynamics of conflict. Why do we double down in our position? Together with our guests, we explore how the power of understanding one another can lead to better solutions. We will also share tips for managing your own mediation practice.
Hi, I'm Phuong Ertley, and I'm a psychotherapist. I help families and couples understand, address, and heal relationship difficulties. That's why I'm excited to be here with Jennifer Sullivan on The Other Chair.
I'm Jennifer Sullivan, and I'm a lawyer who wears a few different hats professionally. What really excites me is understanding how conflicts arise and how to help people navigate their way out of them. That's what Phuong Ertley and I will be talking about on The Other Chair podcast.
In this episode, we interview Amanda Ripley, an investigative journalist for Time, The Atlantic, and other magazines, about her latest book, High Conflict: Why We Get Trapped and How We Get Out. We recorded this interview in 2021, just as the book was coming out, and since then, the ideas have become only more relevant on a global level. Obviously, humans are never going to live in total harmony, but surely we can do better. And this is Amanda's focus. In a politically polarized society, with media platforms that narrow our understanding of the other side, how do we work our way out of unproductive or high conflict and into the healthy, productive variety? Listen on to learn more.
The first year after the 2016 election, I was just sort of at sea trying to figure out how to be useful in such a politically polarized climate, where, you know, roughly half the country believed the places I was writing for were intentionally lying. So that's a very different world from the one that I entered 20 years ago as a journalist working for Time magazine. So part of what I was doing here was to say, okay, is there some other way to do this, to do conflict, to cover conflict? And that's what led me to mediators like you all, to, because you understand conflict differently than journalists. And so for me, this has been a long journey of trying to figure out how to be useful in this climate as a journalist. So now it's like, well, people feel like they don't want to talk to each other because the other side is insane and not tethered to reality. And so as a journalist, what do you do from there? So that's what I'm thinking about a lot.
You're saying that you were noticing that journalism needed to change because you're noticing this extreme polarization.
Journalism has changed in some ways and not changed enough in others, I would say. So the reasons for our polarization, you probably know some of them already, so I don't spend too much time on it, but they include media platforms and business models that incentivize extremism, right? And that narrow our understanding of the other side. So we could design media platforms and business models that do something different. And I think we will eventually. But for now, and particularly in the last 15 years, you know, print media, which is what I work for, was just desperate for a business model that was viable. And the most obvious and easiest option is to get clicks, as many clicks as possible. And one particularly lazy way to do that, in my opinion, is to frighten people, to enrage people. And so there's this system that we're in, which was disrupted by the internet and other things. And the way they adapted was to do things that made the conflict worse. Now, it's also true that Fox News has been doing this for a long time, right? So before the internet was a competitor for the news business, Fox News figured out that you could narrowcast to conservatives who were not being well served by mainstream news organizations, in my opinion, and really dial up the fear. And that worked pretty well. Local TV news all over the country figured that out a long time ago as well. for ratings purposes. So there were a bunch of systems and incentives that helped get us here from a media point of view. Then there's a political point of view. There's a legal point of view, right? There's a lot of different forces. But I think, yes, journalism changed and in the wrong direction and hasn't really yet figured out how to do something differently. I mean, there are exceptions to that for sure.
Yeah.
In the field of psychology, there's this form of therapy called narrative therapy. So narrative therapy basically notices that the stories we tell ourselves oftentimes compounds the problem, meaning that we get stuck on the most excitatory part of the story or the part of the story that we felt shocked by or stuck in. And then we forget all the details that either surrounded it or preceded it or is after it. And so when you're doing narrative therapy with somebody, you listen to where they're stuck and then you kind of open their perspective. You ask them, oh, so before that car accident, what were you doing that morning? And so they start remembering the details. And when you remember more details, you know, that compelling theme that you had about that story where like maybe the theme was in that car accident, I was helpless. If you remember that morning, maybe you remembered how great you felt when you woke up that morning, you know, like how competent you are at your job or, you know, wow, your child did something that made you feel really great. And then your idea of yourself changes just from adding in that detail. And I love what you did with, you know, the children who asking these stories on the tail end, because oftentimes when we're stuck on that really exciting moment, we forget that, oh, and this happened after the car accident. So-and-so helped me. Actually, someone did help me. And you take it to present time where, oh, I'm still alive. Look at that. And then you ask, well, what did you learn from that experience? And then you maybe, they can stitch in the learning, right? Like, well, I learned not to drive at night when my vision isn't so great. You know, so that story then has a whole new worth and a whole new meaning and is valuable to you in a different way and in a way that's more empowering.
I love that.
So I feel like intuitively you just kind of hit on that, like, oh, look, there's this part of the spectrum of that whole story that's missing. Let's add that in, add complexity to that story. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And also it sounds like an uplifting note, right? Because in the end, no matter what happened, if you're still alive, something was valuable from that experience. And even if it's the fact that you survived.
That's so interesting. And I think like part of the way I think of what you're doing there with your client is sort of widening the lens on the story, right? So they can see in the periphery. And it's so valuable in our personal lives, right? But also in our work. And I think often it is, you know, it is, there's something, you said it well, like there's, we get stuck on the most exciting part of the narrative, right? Mm-hmm. And I would say that's true with journalists too. Like journalists are not separate from the political conflict we're in. Like they're in it. They're subject to the same psychological biases and emotions that are totally, you know, understandable. But they have to, I think, to be useful, find ways to get a little distance, not too much, from that, and think about how we can help readers or audiences do what you just described. Like, how can we help people see what happened first or what happened after? Journaling is so helpful for this, right? Personally, because like, you know, for a long time, I had it in my head, like, man, before the pandemic, everything was so much better. You get kind of fixated on all the loss and all the loss of control and frustrations. And when you go back, you can see, oh yeah, that problem was like the same before, you know, like I had that, there's some pre-existing things here that you lose when you get very stuck on the things that are happening to you, which are also true, right? Do you ever find like resistance from clients when you try to do that, when you ask about the morning of the accident, or are people generally pretty open once you start down that path?
Yeah, the response is kind of like the people that you interviewed, Amanda. It's like, oh, no one ever asked me. You know, it evokes a sense of curiosity and wonder. And oftentimes people like what they find, you know. It's that life, you know, has good details in it or meaningful details in it that you know, when we actually acknowledge them, it enriches the story and in a good way, usually.
Yeah, it's actually, I think, this great shining hope, at least in my mind, that we have so flooded the zone when it comes to fear and outrage that there's now a huge demand and market for something else among the public. And so a huge barrier right now, in my opinion, is just the legacy mindsets and habits and rituals of newsrooms, as opposed to the reality of readers and audiences. So just as an example, I'm working on a piece for The Atlantic, and I've been talking to one particular local TV news company that's tried to change what it does in order, very overtly, in order to sustain its audiences over time, not to be, you know, a good person. I mean, although that's in there, right? But this is the good news. Like, there's a financial incentive, which means it might actually happen. And what the executive at this news company told me is, I think people are done being afraid, he said. Mm. And for a TV news executive to say that is a huge deal. I'm just saying that one of the core tenets, particularly of TV news, but other formats too, has been fear, whether we admit it or not. And so for him to say that people are done with it and that he can see that in the Nielsen ratings is a very big deal. I was just doing some research on the study of curiosity and the sort of academic definition of curiosity is when there's a knowledge gap. So when something happens that surprises you based on what you thought you knew, and then you want to resolve that tension, it's almost an aversive feeling sometimes, like, but it's positive in the sense that it makes you want to know more, right? Curiosity is how you get readers, right? Like, that is a very important ingredient. It's like the olive oil of journalism. Like, it's essential to the whole process. And so if you're inundated with fear and outrage and anger and hopelessness as an audience member or reader, and some news outlet gives you something different, then that is going to incite curiosity, right? So that's what I mean about, we may have reached a kind of inflection point where people are just so burned out on fear and shock and sadness that there's an opportunity if we can seize it. So there's a professor at Columbia named Peter Coleman who studies conflict, and he actually has a new book out as well. And he runs this, he and his colleagues run this lab, like you mentioned, called the Difficult Conversations Lab. So like you, as soon as I heard that, I was like, I'm coming up there. And so he very graciously allowed me to come and participate, and they matched me. So they have you fill out like a survey about some controversial issues, and then they try to find someone who disagrees with you strongly on one of them, right? So in my case, they got me on the question of safe spaces and trigger words on campus. And so I was paired with this grad student, and we went into a small room. And the deal is they give you 20 minutes to see if you can come up with a statement on the subject to which you could both, in theory, sign your name and publish publicly. And they record the conversation to see how it goes. And the experimental research is really interesting. And where this comes in is right before you get in that little room, and they give each of you something to read. And what they found is if they give you a story, like a news story, not very long, about some other controversial topic, let's say gun control or abortion, and the story is kind of traditional news story with like two sides back and forth, then you go on to have, you know, not great conversations on average. But if they give you a story that's the same length and covers a lot of the same facts, but is more complicated, So it sort of allows that there aren't just two sides. There's many sides. It's a difficult situation. Then people tend on average to have much better conversations. So what do we mean by better? So in this case, better means you still get angry and frustrated. You don't change your mind, but they can see that there's more of a galaxy of emotions. There's more movement, right? And I think as mediators, you might appreciate that, that you get angry and frustrated, but then there's flashes of curiosity, of understanding, maybe humor, more questions get asked in the conversation, and people leave more satisfied with the experience. So we were given a more complicated story to read right before then, and we had our conversation, and nobody freaked out. Nobody started calling each other's names or anything. But it is true that afterward, it kind of took a little bit of the wind out of my sails on that topic. So it was harder to be so convicted, you know, which has pros and cons. Like if I were leading a movement against campus safe spaces for some reason, that probably wouldn't be that helpful, right? But as a human, I think it's super helpful, right? And certainly as a journalist, but as a human, there is something really, really appealing, as you said, Jennifer, about being right and knowing you're right and being clear and convicted and having to loosen your grip on that just a little bit is really healthy, even if it's less fun on some level or less satisfying on some level.
I think it's such a deep human need to feel like you are a part of something greater than yourself. And yet the ways that maybe we have been taught or conditioned to, you know, you have to belong to sports teams where suddenly you're like playing against your best friend or your neighbor, you know, whereas before that division didn't exist. But in order for there to be a winner and a loser, you have to divide. It seems like either you have to be an adversary or you have to be totally loyal and agree with everything. And either way you do that, you kind of lose, because you lose that complex part of yourself. Like you lose a bit of yourself in order to fit in one way or the other.
I think that's right. There is a really strong need to belong. And we know from the research that it's pretty much just as strong as like the need for food. I mean, it's not actually that different, right? And it's so given that, there is a sadness, a fear that comes with feeling like we don't belong if we disagree with someone we care about or someone we identify with, right? I also wonder if there's something to do with frustration and a lack of control in other parts of our life. Like, is there something about, you know, slamming someone on social media that feels particularly good when you feel like there's nothing else you can do? You know what I mean? Like, if you feel like things are out of control, things are happening in the country that you don't think are right, and your day-to-day life, you can't control very much at all, maybe is that like one thing where you could stand up? You could, and I think there's a kind of magical thinking around the effect that might have, right? Like, so the intent, which is not always bad, the intent is I'm going to call this person out because I have to stand up for what's right, you know? And if I do that, I will begin to make it harder for these beliefs to flourish. I will change people's minds, or at least make it less acceptable, right? But in a highly divided climate where people are very entrenched, typically has the opposite effect, right? So the intent is to make the world better, and it typically doesn't work the way we expect. So yeah, at the same time, I could imagine a different Twitter or Facebook mm-hmm. that was designed to be less adversarial, right? If they had designed Twitter like this from the beginning, then you can shift those norms. Now, it's very hard to do it now, right? Because it raises this whole specter of censorship and political correctness, as we've seen with deplatforming, right? So once you've gotten this far down the rabbit hole, it's hard to redesign it. But I personally would much rather be on a social media site that helped incentivize. You know, I don't want to get a flag on my account that says tends to forward false information, you know? But as it is, there's every incentive to forward false information.
That makes me think it would be great, first of all, to have that overlay and to have new Twitter and new Facebook and everything else. And then on top of that, it would be nice to go a little further and start to have some kind of word for this thing that we do when we're just operating in the binary. Because I think that's where, you know, once you get past the bots and the people who are intentionally pushing misinformation, we still have this huge problem because we still have people who are just operating in a very simplistic way, which does tend to stoke outrage, as you talk about in your book.
I mean, in the book, I call it conflict entrepreneurs. These are people mm-hmm. who intentionally exploit conflict, but that's not quite right. So it's more like...
it's like a button pusher or something along yeah. those lines. Yeah. And I'm curious then, because you've been so immersed in it for so long, and you talk a little bit about how it's changed you as a person and that you don't use the word they as much, and you try to not fall prey to those binary modes of thinking. Is this something that has the power of this message that you've learned changed people around you?
You know, I live in Washington, D.C., which is an extremely democratic district. It's like the most homogenous politically district in the country. So everybody voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016. I mean, literally 95% of people. And for Biden, this last go around. So there's also, it's a pretty high education level on average in the city. And so that two combinations, we know from the research, the more partisan you are, the more political news you consume, and the more highly educated you are, the more ignorant you are about the other political side, and the more mistakes you make. So literally news and education have the reverse effect on your level of understanding of the other political side than what they are supposed to do.
Wow, so I feel like that's shocking right there. Like, I feel like that message should be shared broadly.
Yeah, there's a sort of tragic quality to it, right? It's like the more you know, the less you know. And so that makes it hard, I think, to reconsider, you know, to at that level of engagement and activism, particularly when, like, a lot of people in DC where I live have been sort of subject to this, to the last administration, you know, if they work for the federal government or whatever, or if they're journalists, you know, the way that Trump would actively demonize and vilify their jobs and their work is very hard. I mean, you know, in that, when you feel that level of attacked, it's not really reasonable. The same is true for, you know, immigrants, people of color. Like, if you feel attacked like that and you are being threatened, then I don't know if it's reasonable to ask people to get super curious.
So Amanda, this book is so interesting in the way that you have structured it. And it seems like you structured it primarily around five main stories. And they're very different stories about very different kinds of conflict.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I noticed in trying to learn about conflict myself is that there were some really good books about interpersonal conflict. And then there were some really good books about, you know, large-scale conflict, like the Troubles in Northern Ireland or War in Rwanda, right? But there weren't a lot of books that connected the dots between very different conflicts and how human behavior may or may not be consistent. And so part of the goal in choosing the case studies was to go from smaller to bigger as far as the intensity of the conflict and the violence and scale of the conflict, and then go back down to interpersonal. So the whole challenge was to find people who have been through a transformation in conflict, right? Who were in sort of, you know, unhealthy conflicts and got to a place where they didn't find resolution, but it was a much more productive kind of conflict, whether it was political or personal, neighborhood conflict, whatever. And so those people have a lot of, you know, insight, right? Because they can see, the water they're swimming in, right? They can see how they were before, how they are now, what it took to get there. Are there patterns when it comes to, you know, leaving gang violence or leaving a guerrilla group in Colombia or, you know, being a different kind of politician? You know, it sounds like very different, and they are very different situations, right? But there are some patterns in what that looks like and how we can help people make those transitions. So that was the idea, is sort of like, first, how do we get sucked into conflict? Which Gary was incredibly helpful and vulnerable and open about. And then how do we get back out to a place that is more useful to us and to everyone else? So there are a lot of people who are in conflict, I discovered. You probably know that. And there are a lot of people, a fair number of people who have moved to a better place through a lot of hard work and help. And then there's a smaller number who have done those things and are very reflective and open to talking about it publicly, right? So it's all about finding those people who really do feel comfortable sharing their story and then trying to see, okay, how does each one build on the next so that it's helpful to the reader and not, you know, repetitive.
In your book, you introduced this idea that was new to me, was there's a productive conflict and not productive conflict. Now, prior to reading your book, I thought it was just conflict. So, and what was also interesting was that you, the differentiation between the two is that you said coming out of a productive conflict, you still have your dignity intact. So I want to go deeper into that idea, Amanda, because dignity seems to be such an intangible, and yet it's a defining sense between the two.
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, I sort of think of high conflict as the unproductive, destructive kinds of conflict that can really start over something pretty small, actually, but they escalate. They usually are an us versus them kind of conflict. They tend to get very clear about who's right, who's wrong. Usually they are sort of inflamed by experiences of humiliation by conflict entrepreneurs, you know, people or companies that intentionally incite unhealthy conflict. And they tend to get to a place where everybody suffers, but to different degrees. And eventually, and this is maybe the scariest part to me, eventually, everyone I've ever seen who's been in high conflict ends up mimicking the behavior of their adversary. You know, if you think about the example of Gary, who ran for local office in his small town in California, he did that because he wanted to show there was a different way to move through conflict where you didn't vilify each other, right? That was more inclusive. And he found himself excluding people. I wouldn't say he vilified people, but he certainly, you know, categorized people in his mind in ways that were negative, simplified, generalized, all those things that really bothered him about politics, he ended up repeating for a while before he realized what had happened and started to change what he was doing. And then that shifted him into what I call good conflict. But the idea of good conflict, and I think we've all kind of felt or at least witnessed both of these things, right? High conflict and good conflict. Good conflict can be stressful and heated. Anger holds out the possibility of redemption. Like, you want the person to be better. Whereas contempt is like you've given up on them. So good conflict can be heated. It can be stressful. It's certainly uncomfortable. Going back to what we said about how we don't, you know, we resist it at first, but it's the kind of thing where you retain some level of openness, right? Like curiosity, the ability to learn something you didn't know about yourself or the other person or the problem. Doesn't always happen, but there's a possibility there, right? And I think it's just, in addition to being much more effective, and we know this from the research, that that kind of conflict tends to lead to much more lasting change over time. It also, I think, is just better for you, like better for your soul, you know, like it doesn't feel good. And it's physically very unhealthy to marinate in high conflict. And we've all felt that, right? That frustration, that rage, that contempt. So it is very destructive to your own health. And eventually you can end up destroying something that you hold dear. So that shift is really important. And to finally answer your question about dignity, to me, being able to retain your dignity in conflict means being the person you want to be, like being able to still defend yourself and express what you think without fear, and not collapsing into simplicity and dehumanizing language or threats or violence. Towards the end of the book, we meet this group from New York City who does this very weird and inspiring exchange with these conservative Trump supporters from rural Michigan. And one of the New Yorkers who did this exchange, she said to me, and by the way, she hasn't changed her mind on anything, right? She's quite an activist on the left. She said, I feel like I was the person I was meant to be. You know, I'm paraphrasing, but she said, I like how I felt when I was in those conversations with these conservatives, because she was able to be open, able to be curious, and able to say what she really thought. So that's how I think about dignity, but I'm curious if you have other thoughts.
Well, the thing it made me think about, I haven't thought that long and hard about dignity, but your book made me think a lot about humiliation, and you talk about humiliation as being one of the four fire starters that you talk about in the book, and the danger of it. And you had this quote, which I thought was amazing, from Thomas Friedman, who said, "If I've learned one thing about covering world affairs, it's this: the single most underappreciated force in international relations is humiliation." And you talk about that as being a really powerful understory to conflict. And then you mentioned specifically about how people who were interviewed in conflicts in Somalia and Rwanda mentioned humiliation, that was a big part of what they talked about, but it wasn't necessarily a big part of what gets told in stories about conflict. And it seems to me like that idea of humiliation is the flip side. It's the thing, you know, we're not leaving people with dignity when we demonize them. We are oftentimes humiliating them, seeking to humiliate. And it also made me think of that video that was forwarded quite a bit for a while about Trump at that correspondence dinner where President Obama at the time made fun of him, and people hypothesized that this was the indignity that led him to go out and run for president.
Absolutely. As I was marinating in this question, as both of you were speaking, I realized that, you know, I said it was an intangible, but I realized that it's also a felt feeling, meaning that, you know, when you feel like you can stand your ground, you know, you feel those, you can feel into those words, right? You feel the strength of your own legs. And when you stand your ground and you speak your truth, right? There's something very enlivening about that stance. And when you think of humiliation, it's like this collapse through your center. You don't even have enough energy to look around you. You're mostly downcast. Your eyes are looking down at the ground. It's almost like you're getting smaller. You're taking less space. So if you compare the two, those are very different ways of being in the world. Ways of embodying yourself or facing another person, right? One, in humiliation, you don't face them at all. And when you have your dignity, you stand upright, you have your full length, whatever your height is, you embody it. So there are different ways of just existing in the world. And who wants to be a shadow of themselves?
I like this idea that it's a physical felt feeling, dignity and humiliation, right? Like they're both, you're right. And it makes me think about how you need to feel like you're not going to be attacked in order to have that ground, right? That sense of confidence and sort of like a prerequisite, right? Like you can't. So it's such an interesting thing, humiliation. Like I was thinking it'd be, when you were reading that Thomas Friedman quote, I was thinking it'd be so cool if newspapers had humiliation beats. Like if that was like, because I think one of the most frustrating things about the news the last few years is like, you know, where's the psychology? Like you all keep acting like this is just people debating a policy. It's not. It hasn't been for a long time, you know? Mm. So if you had a humiliation beat, that would be really cool. Like what would you cover instead of like Congress? Do you know what I mean? And then it's like, then it's because it's so interesting, humiliation, right? Because it's partly externally caused for sure. And it's partly internally framed. So like the research on humiliation is really slippery. And I don't pretend to have the ultimate understanding of this, but it's like something can happen to me and I'll interpret it like humiliating. Whereas the same thing happens to my friend and she doesn't interpret it as humiliating. Who's right? You know what I mean? There was a study of Holocaust survivors and they noticed both men and women in this particular study had been harassed by their guards at the camps to make their beds perfectly and kind of, you know, made to redo it over and over. It wasn't just right. And the women did not tend to experience this as humiliation, which doesn't make it okay, right? Obviously. Mm. But they experienced it as something else. Whereas the men tended on average to experience it and describe it as humiliating. So then you get into this really interesting question of like, well, who's right? You know, there are people who always feel humiliated and those tend to be high conflict people like Trump, mm-hmm. who frame a lot of things as a humiliation. And it's a way to also generate more anger from your followers, right? So it's such an interesting subject, right? Because it's a real thing and it's also informed by how we frame things that happen to us, right?
Absolutely. And it makes me think directly in the book of the two stories of Curtis and Sandra. And you talk about how Curtis reacted to the murder of Benji, the basketball star from his neighborhood who was part of his gang, that to him was a form of humiliation, a form of taking something away from him that then mm-hmm. he sought to avenge. And Sandra had seen a terrible murder of her neighbor, but then when she saw the murder of her child's father, right, her boyfriend, right in front of her, she's hiding, but she saw it in close range. That for her was, you know, what you called her saturation point or her low or her point at which she decided, enough of this, I am going to find my way out, and went and found a way out of the guerrilla group that she'd been a part of. So that's interesting too. The two of them had really different reactions to a murder of somebody important to them. And she didn't frame that second one, or she was less interested in the humiliation factor than in the realization that it forced on her that it was time to move on. But you also talk about the fact that people have all these different identities. And at that point, she'd become a mother. And mm-hmm. so maybe part of the reason mm-hmm. for the different reaction was that she had this identity as a mother that was important to her too at that point.
Hmm. Oh, maybe I read it differently. I thought the moment that Sandra saw the murder of this very important woman in her community, I thought that actually galvanized her to become a rebel.
You're both right in my understanding of it, that did make her decide to go fight, and partly because it was so humiliating, you know? Mm. So to take the example of Curtis, when this boy he didn't actually know, but he thought was in his gang, was brutally killed by someone who he thought was in a rival gang, he interpreted that as humiliating. And one of the interesting things about humiliation is it requires a belief that you were above and you've been brought low. So there's an interesting pre-existing power dynamic, however you define yourself, your masculinity, your identity, your status in society seems relevant on some level to whether you're going to interpret something as humiliating. And in Curtis's case, when he was very young, he thought his gang was superior morally, physically to this other gang who he thought were below him from a class point of view, among other things. So the fact that they would rob him of this boyhood hero, which was an absolute tragedy unto itself, also had this overlay of subjugation, right? Of being brought low. So it's really interesting when you think about like politics, where, you know, there are people in America who feel a lot of grievances, right? And some of those are real and undeniable. And you know, can quantify them, right? And see them in history. And some of those are ginned up on purpose, right? So when a Black man gets elected president, it feels humiliating. If that's the mindset you have going into it, right? If it feels like a zero-sum game, where the more Black people win, the more white people lose. Like, so all these kinds of adversarial zero-sum framings can lead to a real, like very, very intense sense of humiliation. Humiliation is not talked about enough. And I've tried to learn, and I, you know, want to get better at this, but I've tried to learn to recognize when I feel it in myself and when I also see others try to invoke it, right? And be just try to get a little distance from that and question it, like hold it up to the light, you know, mm-hmm. Because there's a psychologist who studies humiliation, Lindner is her last name, and she says that humiliation is the nuclear bomb of emotions. Mm-hmm. It is very dangerous when it comes to escalating conflict to make it violent. So it's really important to be, I think, more aware of humiliation and how it flows.
I think that's a really important point, Amanda, in emphasizing how it shouldn't be used as a way to change behavior because it doesn't work. So conversely, how do we cultivate humility? How do we cultivate a more humble sense of our own visions of ourselves? And might that lead to, if all of us practice that, might that lead to less conflict? Because then, you know, if my humiliation button wasn't so big, it's harder for you to get at it.
That's a great point. Yeah, it reminds me, I'm reading this book now that just came out by Adam Grant called Think Again, The Power of Knowing What You Don't Know. And so to your point, maybe humility sounds like a passive tool, but maybe it's not. Like maybe it makes us stronger because we're less vulnerable to humiliation, right? If I don't feel like, you know, like the example I used in the book is how I went golfing for the first time during the pandemic because I had no interest in golfing ever. And yet this was like one thing you could do, right? And so my husband and son and I went golfing and, you know, I was terrible, of course. And like I would more than once try to hit the ball and miss it entirely, which anyone who's tried golfing for the first time probably remembers that feeling. And it was sort of, you know, it's embarrassing, but I wasn't humiliated. Like at all, right? Because I have no identity around this. I don't, you know, I just don't care. I brought a lot of humility to it. Like I knew I would not be good at this. I have a lot to learn. I'm open to learning. I need advice and coaching, right? So like it is like a tiny example of what you're saying is like, if we can bring that humility, does it kind of inoculate us a little bit against conflict entrepreneurs and the power of perceived humiliation? I love that example. I think that idea of humility is a counter to humiliation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes me think of, you talk in your book about how we can put up guardrails to try to avoid veering off into high conflict and to stay in healthy conflict. And it seems like that idea of humility would be one of those guardrails.
Mm-hmm. Like that. Okay. So that could be on our Twitter overlay.
Yes.
Shows humility. Wouldn't that be awesome?
Yes.
Well, Amanda, what was awesome were the very words you just mentioned before in regards to golfing, right? Imagine if we all approached each situation or each conversation with, I don't know much, I don't expect to do really well, and I have a lot to learn here.
You're right. When I was working on education, reading about a mother who had raised her kids half in Japan and half in Massachusetts for various reasons. And she was talking about the various differences she saw, pros and cons. And, you know, it's a big subject, right? But one of the things that I remember is, of course, she noticed how quick parents are to praise kids in America. That's a stereotype, but there's some truth to it, right? And then in Japan, she noticed how like humility was really revered. Again, a stereotype, but there's some truth to it. And she remembers at a high school in Japan where they would start each new school year with one of the sort of top performing, most kind of popular students from the high school, like the oldest grade in the high school, talking to the whole school about something he had failed at in the past year and what had happened and why and what he learned from it and what he might do differently. So that's a sort of ritualistic way to boost humility, right? Like assuming it's genuine and not put on, but like I think in this case it was genuine. And it shows that you can design a school or a church or a political system to build and reward and incentivize humility as much as you do to build and incentivize narcissism or contempt, right?
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think about the B'nai Jeshurun Synagogue in New York that you wrote about in High Conflict. It was one of the last stories that we come to. And talking about before they went and met with the Michigan corrections officers, who are mostly Christian, they had their own internal conflicts that they had to work through. And I wondered if you could talk about that a little bit, because I think it's really illustrative of almost like a roadmap for the way in which that process, the first process that they went through, where they had this massive conflict about basically, you know, loyalty to the state of Israel, and how they worked through that as a congregation or a group, a synagogue. And then that made them more equipped the next time they had a big divisive issue, which I think was interfaith marriage within the synagogue, to work through that.
Yeah, I heard about this from Melissa Weintraub, who is a mediator who does, bridging dialogues. She's done this in the Middle East. She's also a rabbi, and she's done it here in the States. And she runs an organization called Resetting the Table. And I had asked her, like I asked a lot of people working on the book, is there any institution or place, you know, of a community that made a shift in their culture to really kind of cultivate good conflict? And she thought about it and she said, you know, there's a lot of places that call me in to do a workshop or whatever, but they don't really change the culture. And so she said, this place is worth looking into. This synagogue, which is one of the more influential synagogues in America, it's been around since the 1800s on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, was a place that had really done the work and walked the walk in a way that she doesn't usually see. So I reached out to them and yeah, they almost fell into high conflict is what happened in 2012 when there was a big internal kind of schism in the synagogue about Israel. So what happened was the rabbis were more left-leaning on Israel, more critical of Israel's government and some of their decisions around Palestinians. And there were members of their congregation, which was large, it's like 2,400 people, who were much more conservative on Israel. And when the rabbis publicly praised a decision to upgrade Palestine's status in the United Nations, it was for them humiliating, to get back to our earlier conversation. They were felt like it was a betrayal of Israel. And there were plenty of American politicians and Israeli politicians who opposed that UN decision. So there was this whole bigger framing of it, right? That even though it seemed like far away from the synagogue, it felt very close for them. And so the conflict really blew up very quickly and was in the media, and it was like accusations, and people were leaving the synagogue who had been there for generations, you know, and it was very painful. And so to their credit, the rabbi, with urging from members of his congregation, decided to really lean into that conflict in a way that I think mediators will really get and appreciate, the way that many people do not get or appreciate until they've seen it, which is, you know, they brought in Resetting the Table to help them to start to really understand each other, even if they continued to disagree, which they did, of course. And they spent a full year. They had like 25 different conflict encounters is one way to think of them, like, you know, for everything from workshops to like small listening groups to trainings on how to listen to, you know, really get underneath the conflict, to the understory of the conflict, and figure out like, what is Israel really about? Is it just about the status of Palestine in the UN? You know, no, it's not, right? So what is it about for you? What's your history with it? What do you think of when you think of Israel? And one thing they learned very quickly was that there weren't two camps, right? There were many. And it was, for most people, a really hard question, you know, and they felt very torn internally between their sense of duty and loyalty to Israel because of the history of Israel and of the Jews, and also their sense of justice for the Palestinians. And, you know, there's just a lot there. And so they were able to get to a place where, as the rabbi put it, they could tolerate the discomfort of another person's opinion. So they could get to good conflict, where they could get stronger and wiser with the conflict, as opposed to weaker and meaner, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they learned to fight smart and to fight well. And then they did it again with interfaith marriage, as you mentioned. And then they did it finally with the conservatives from Michigan. So it needs, I mean, the thing is, it needs constant practice, right? It's like so many forces in our culture are moving in the direction of high conflict. So, you know, you can't ever really stop, just like in a marriage, right? You can't be like, oh, we're good. Now I can just, you know, fight dirty. Like, it never ends, right?
Well, reading your book, Amanda, I really got the sense of, if we want things to change, it takes a collective effort. You know, you mentioned before about healthy anger, or being in healthy conflict where you're able to say what you need to say and not worry that you'll be attacked for it. It's a sort of intimacy, right? Being able to really reveal your thoughts, even if you're certain that the other person might not take well to it, but you're willing to take that risk in order to be known, and in order to even to understand yourself more fully. In terms of human relating, it's a deep need that we have, not only to belong because we fit in the mold, but also to be different and still be loved and still be okay. Yeah, we really need that sort of reassurance, and reassurance comes from others, right? It comes from a community. And it seems like the example you gave about the synagogue was that there was enough of like-minded people with the same values who are willing to do this work with you, to lean into this high conflict, sorry, this conflict, this productive conflict with you, in order to feel like they know you better, and to connect with you more, and to appreciate you more. So it seems like, you know, a lot of our questions today is, well, how are these ideas in your book useful to us, and how can we be useful to each other? And it seems like one of the main takeaways I'm hearing is that we need to communicate with each other more. We need to get into conflict, healthy conflict with each other more. We need to want to understand each other more and do it more often. And that all requires community.
Right. So it's like there needs to be some baseline level of affection or shared sense of purpose, at least, right? For those other things to really flourish. I think that's right. And that's gotten really hard because we're so segregated politically, especially in this country. You know, the rate of people marrying someone from a different political persuasion has dropped 50% since I was a kid. That's a huge change because we talk a lot about social media, right? But the family and what you hear at home as a kid has got to be just as powerful, if not more, right? And we know from the research that when kids hear different political views from their parents, they tend to grow up with more nuanced sense of the other side, whatever side they end up on. So it's a way to really generate that baseline affection that you're talking about from the beginning. And if you don't have that, if your parents are always railing against the unknown other, right? Mm-hmm. Then you lose that, you know, you lose that. And so we know from a ton of research that one of the ways to build that affection is through working on shared problems together. And we know from the research that can help develop that kind of base foundation of affection, even as you disagree. And then going into those conflicts tends to be healthier.
Yeah, I mean, that makes me think of the book, Good to Great. They have the example of the company that made vast improvements by choosing a goal of improved company safety. It was intended to be a goal that nobody could argue about, and they all decided they would work towards this goal together. And the real thing that the CEO wanted to work on was to improve the company. It was problems with the toxic culture and things like that. But he chose this unifying goal, and because everybody agreed that they could work together and they needed to work together to achieve this goal, they fixed a whole bunch of other problems too. So that does seem like one of the elements that you can use to bring people together.
Yeah. Like there needs to be some semblance of equal power, if not in society, then in the room, you know, like just throwing a bunch of people on the same problem without kind of thinking about those power dynamics and how you can make them somewhat equitable. It doesn't have to be perfect, never is, right? But, you know, I've sat in on really hard conversations between people of different races about the Confederate flag, Black and white people in America about the Confederate flag. And on the one hand, the white people in that room, there's more power there, right? So you think, well, this can't work. On the other hand, the Black people in the room had certain things about them. I mean, we all have multiple identities, right? So that kind of equaled out either by dint of the amount of education they had or their role in the community. In one case, it was a religious leader, right? So you can get to a place where it's not perfect, it never is, but what you don't want is a huge imbalance, right? So that's one of the conditions. And it helps also, it's important to have some kind of third party, right? That both sides respect or trust vaguely, that kind of puts its stamp of approval and supports the bigger mission of coming together. So in this case, like you mentioned with the company, it could be the CEO or whatever. With countries, it's often, you know, the United Nations, which again is imperfect, right? But, or the United States or Sweden or like other countries, third countries will come in. So the convening host is an important piece of it. But I mean, I think nationally, some kind of national service program, if you did it well, would be a way to deal with some of this, right? because it would give us all some common experiences and some opportunities to work on problems together with some structure around it.
Well, it's been such a delight hearing from the author of High Conflict, Amanda. I know for myself, just the idea of conflict seems very aversive, but truth be told, I'm in it whether I want to be or not. So it's, I think it behooves us to learn ways to navigate it in a way that we might get the outcomes that we want and that we might have stronger relationships. We might feel more dignified in the process or get to know each other better. So thank you so much for a book that really shows us the positive things that can happen when people really deeply and thoughtfully engage with this topic.
Thank you for having me on. And I also want to just thank the Center for Understanding and Conflict, which is one of the main ways I ended up getting curious about conflict and all that I didn't know years ago. And Gary Friedman, of course, in particular, but I'm very grateful to know that there is this community of people out in the world trying to create good conflict. And it's not easy work, that much I know. So it's incredibly important though, and maybe now more than any time in my lifetime. So thank you for having me on.
Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you for listening to our interview with Amanda Ripley, author of High Conflict. Do you have any good stories about how you were able to resolve a conflict in your life? Did it involve a mediator? We would love to know. You can find out more about the Center for Understanding and Conflict at www.understandingandconflict.org. You can also follow Amanda Ripley and learn more about her at www.amandaripley.com.